This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today, we have rebroadcasts of two previous interviews. Coming up, we discuss what time school starts with Kalamazoo Regional Educational Service Agency Superintendent Dave Campbell. But first, a look at the history of healthcare in the United States. Over the years, Kalamazoo Dr. Ken Fisher has spoken with us about his writings on end-of-life care and healthcare reform. He joined us earlier this year to discuss his new e-book, Understanding Healthcare, A Historical Perspective. The interview originally aired in May. Ken Fisher, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure being here, Gordon. It's always fun talking with you.
Why did you want to take this look at healthcare through the lens of history?
Well, because I wanted to show people how difficult it is to change ideas. You know, once an idea gets established, it's very hard to change it. The second reason was I wanted to show that the scientific revolution that was started by Copernicus and Rasselas in the 1500s led to people to look at issues in medicine, and that the giants of the 19th century, Virchow and Pasteur and everything, started the real revolution in medicine based on science and knowledge instead of superstition. And then how the AMA got started by people who were on the right side of history, understood science. And then how people got off track and has led to total confusion and complexity, which nobody understands. So that's why I wrote the book.
Can you explain a little bit more about that idea of science and medicine merging together and the process under which that happened?
Sure. I spend a good deal of time talking about that. Chapter one explains that two doctors, Copernicus and Versalis, Copernicus, who we all know was a great astronomer, and really laid the groundwork for the idea that the Earth is not the center of the solar system, but the sun is, which was a radical idea at the time. But he used data, and he created a hypothesis and then tested his hypothesis. So in the first chapter, I talk about the scientific method. And Versalis was a surgeon and an anatomist, and he refuted Galen's idea, an ancient Roman, Greek physician to Roman emperors. And he had written an anatomy book, which was followed for over 1,000 years. The only problem was he didn't dissect humans. He dissected ox. And so his book was wrong. And this went on for over 1,000 years. And then Versalis published, and they both published the same year. I believe it was 1543, but it's in the book. I'm not sure exactly when. And then that led to thinking that, and then the Enlightenment came with the idea, well, people have minds and they can think. So let's try to think our way through things instead of just accepting dogma. And the great breakthrough came in the late 1700s and the 1800s with Jenner, with smallpox vaccination, Pasteur, Virchow, and I go through a whole list. It's not complete, of these really giant minds that laid the foundation for scientific medicine.
One of the other important milestones you talk about is when mental health began to be considered along with physical health.
Exactly. And that is our old friend Sigmund Freud, who again did his work in the late 1800s. So the 19th century is really the foundation of modern medicine. And then medicine before then was not a big deal. You had as much chance dying being treated by a doctor as you had of surviving. So then as science moved forward, it's very interesting. Most of this was happening in Europe. And as the colonies got developed into a country, there was very few educated doctors in the European style, where they had to go to college and then learn medicine, et cetera, et cetera. It was more of an apprenticeship model. And that's where Nathan Smith Davis came in, who founded the American Medical Association and said, no, this is, although he was trained that way, he recognized this is not right.
And we eventually got medical schools.
Exactly.
Which also changed the game, right?
That's right. Well, yes and no. Not initially. Yes, the University of Pennsylvania was the first medical school, and then I list the beginning medical schools, 4, 5, 6. But it turns out they could never meet the need. There were so few, they could never meet the need. And as the population of America grew way beyond anybody's expectations, there started to be proprietary medical schools where 2, 3, 4 doctors would set up a medical school. They'd charge for a lecture. You'd stay there for 3, 5, 6 months. You'd apprentice with one of them. And after a year or something, you're now a doctor.
And they were sort of running this as a side business.
That's right.
Right.
And it was, and those were most of the doctors in the United States. And it was actually these gentlemen in the AMA who believed they were on the right side of history because they believed that you needed both science and the ability to understand people, that it was a deep human connection that provided good medicine, which was based on the fundamentals of science, but you always had to adjust the fundamentals to the individual person.
So as you say, the American Medical Association was on the right side of history, in your view, for a very long time.
Right.
Where is the point where you would say they started to slip and get on the wrong side of history?
It's a very interesting question. In the early 1900s, the AMA and its leaders were quite concerned about the health of the entire population. And part of their prestige was pushing public health and public health initiatives, very forward-thinking, and in large part led by their founder, Nathan Smith Davis, who was a giant of an intellect. And he was the dean of the founding schools of Northwestern University. It wasn't started as Northwestern University Medical School for over 30 years. And he was also the founder of the Northwestern Law School. I mean, this guy was out of sight. So these people were very concerned. There was a major switch, and the major switch came around 1920. Although they were correct in saying this bond between physician and patient is critically important for good medicine, they got tied up with the fact that they didn't want any other interference. So they were totally, at first they were totally against insurance, but they finally went with that. But they fought government subsidies for insurance. They were afraid that the government would get into the exam room, which has actually happened. So they were so concerned about that that their minds were frozen, and they couldn't say, well, why can't the government just subsidize people so that they can go out and get their own care? It never dawned on them. They were so adamant about this. So from 1920 to 1965, they fought everything. So they were on the wrong side of history.
You say, though, throughout the book that they didn't have counterproposals.
That's right.
They were fighting everybody else's ideas, but never really coming up with something of their own to say, here's another way of doing it.
That's right. They never came up with a middle-of-the-ground solution. You know, something that would, one, maintain the physician-patient intense relationship, yet on the other hand, for people who can't afford that kind of thing, to be able to support them in some way that could continue to happen. And by not proposing an alternative, they, in essence, their greatest fears came about.
Do you see any parallel between that situation and today? I mean, people who have heard you interviewed on this station, other places,
sure,
know you do not like the Affordable Care Act or
That's
Obamacare.
Right.
But is there a lack of a real alternative out there that's in the public sphere anyway, or in the public square being debated about what might be done instead?
Yes, there is. the idea to me is that every person should have the ability to obtain excellent care. And that's really in society's interest. You know, a lot of people say you should do it from a moral point of view, and that's probably true. But it's also in society's interest that everybody be as healthy as possible. So how is a way to do that that can be done and maintain that relationship with the physician and a patient and not put the country into bankruptcy, as is happening? And of course there is a way. And it's been shown in other countries, in Switzerland and in Hong Kong. And it's also been shown in Indiana with the poorest of the poor. Indiana, Mitch Daniels, when he was governor, initiated a plan where a certain group of Medicaid patients would receive a payment each year into a health savings account, which they could then use to go see a physician of their choice and pay that physician a reasonable amount. They also provided for these people insurance for catastrophic events. So the real idea of insurance, we have morphed health insurance actually into prepaid health care. It's not really insurance. Insurance for your house is if it burns down, but insurance doesn't pay if you paint it. And your car insurance. So people are familiar with the idea of real insurance. If you need an oil change, you don't call up the insurance company to try to get an oil change. So Mitch Daniels did this, and it worked beautifully. So there are instances, and now direct primary care is growing, where people pay a primary care doctor $50, $60, $70 a month, depending on how many family members and this, that, and the other thing. And that's growing. So there is something out there, but it's very difficult for the majority of people to understand this.
Okay. We talked about health savings accounts the last time you were here.
Yeah,
and
right.
I would, I guess, recommend people maybe go to that interview, which is on our website, if they want a more detailed breakdown of that. One thing I did not ask you last time that I probably should have. The idea, you mentioned that people could on their own get health savings accounts and then high deductible insurance plans.
Sure.
But you also said that you wouldn't want to require anybody to do that.
Right.
Would those high deductible insurance plans be eligible to someone with a pre-existing condition, or could they be denied by a pre-existing condition?
Well, not now, because I think that's one part of the Affordable Care Act that is positive. In Chapter 10, I cover this in detail, and I make it a voluntary thing. In other words, why shouldn't Americans have a choice?
And you say health savings accounts would be one choice on top of the others that we have, right?
Yes. So people could choose. But to make it work, we have to change the IRS code a little bit and expand health savings accounts so that they can pay for a direct primary care doctor or a direct doctor. And we can talk about that, how there really isn't a doctor shortage. We'll talk about that. And can pay for their high deductible plan. So the idea of a health savings account, I think, has to be expanded if it's going to be widely used.
The reason I ask about the pre-existing conditions is because one of the arguments for the individual mandate is you can't just have people buying insurance after they get sick or after they're in a car accident. So if somebody doesn't get this high deductible plan, you know, do we allow them to come in and buy insurance after they get a cancer diagnosis, for instance?
Sure. I think that's a very reasonable question. I think the idea that I'm trying to get people to understand is you would have a health savings account for your child. As soon as your child's born, you start putting money into the health savings account, and that's a tax credit.
Right, which the number you gave last time was $2,000 a
right.
year. With a chronic disease, though, you could spend $2,000 quick.
No question. So, but you have a high deductible plan the day you're born with this idea. So you are enrolled in a high deductible plan.
Along with your health savings account.
Exactly.
They're tied together, in other
That's
words.
Right. That's right. And even today, you can't open a health savings account without a high deductible plan. You can't have one.
And you think that should be the case?
Oh, yes.
That should be a requirement.
Right. So that the idea is that everybody would have some kind of health insurance plan. And then, of course, hospitals could then be deemed, the non-for-profit status could be done away with, and then hospitals could compete for patients like everybody else.
I want to go back to what you said, though, at the beginning, that you do believe that people in the United States should have access to quality medical care.
Absolutely.
Does that make healthcare a right? At least, you know, basic healthcare, life-saving healthcare?
Well, I think it depends what you call a right. I think it's in society's interest that that happens. We want people as healthy as possible to be as productive as possible throughout their lives. So I say that it is in society's interest to do this. If you want to call it a right, that's fine. But I think it's easier to sell this to people as it's in your interest. Your standard of living will improve if everybody is productive as much as possible. So so that's why I try to make it, I try to say it, it's in everybody's interest to do this, not some kind of moral directive.
The way I hear you talk about that, though, kind of reminds me of the history of the Kalamazoo school case. Where the question was, can there be publicly financed schools? And the opinion came back, yes, because it is in the interest of the community to have a well-educated populace. Is that the way maybe we should be trying to think about healthcare? It's in our interest that not only am I healthy, but my neighbors are healthy as well.
Well, to me, that's exactly correct. That is exactly correct. And so why should people pay taxes or provide enough tax funding so that everybody, if they wish, can have a tax credit to have one of these expanded health savings accounts with the high deductible plan? It's in your interest for everybody to be able to do this, and let people choose. Let the market decide what people want. Give people choices. Isn't that the American way? Instead of trying to jam something down people's throats, which in turn is causing the courts to be filled with all these cases and all this rigmarole and fighting, I think it's kind of silly. I mean, just give people an alternative.
Ken Fisher is a Kalamazoo doctor. He's also the author of the ebook Understanding Healthcare, A Historical Perspective. Dr. Fisher, once again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The interview with Ken Fisher originally aired in May. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When should school start? Not should it start before or after Labor Day, but what time should it begin? The online news service Bridge took a look at that question earlier this year. We spoke with one of the educators interviewed for that story, Kalamazoo Regional Educational Service Agency Superintendent Dave Campbell. The interview originally aired in June. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to begin with your quote in this story. You say that this is one of a long list of things we do that is not best for kids. Why is it not best for kids?
Well, that's an interesting statement I made there. And really, within the context of what I said, what I was getting at is there's a lot of things we do as a society that are not necessarily in the best interest of students' learning. That would be the broader context. And I think this school starting time issue is a classic example. The research is pretty clear that teenagers really would perform better if they started school later. And the schools that have tried that, you know, they've seen some good success, primarily because it improves attendance and tardiness, which is just logical. But we don't do it very often. We don't tend to have high schools in particular starting later in the morning because there's so many other issues and factors that are really more societal related than just school. And so you know, there are a number of things, and we can talk about some of those later. So, yeah, it's a hard issue because when you think about what you'd have to do to have a high school start later in the day, somebody's going to have to start earlier in the day. And unless you go to a single bus run system, which is very expensive and very difficult to manage because you need double the number of buses and you need double the number of drivers, and there's already a terrific shortage of bus drivers. And if you have need twice as many drivers and they're going to make about half the amount of money because they're working half the amount of hours, you're going to have a staggering bus driver shortage. And so, right, it'd be best for student learning to maybe to have the secondary students start later, but how are we going to get all the kids to school on time is really a difficult challenge, because staying in a double bus run system, which is far more efficient, well, then you'd have to have the elementary kids start earlier. Now, if you start the elementary students earlier, then they're going to be the ones standing on the side of the road at about 6:30 in the morning on a cold winter morning, and there's going to be a lot of folks that think that don't think that's a real good idea, and that tends to win at the end of the day is, you know, do you really want little children out on the side of the road in the dark in the winter?
So high school students start the earliest,
yes,
and then middle school and then elementary. Is that what works in most districts?
Yeah, typically something like that. A lot of times it's divided by elementary and secondary, so you make the division somewhere around fifth grade or something. This can be different district to district depending on their grade configuration.
Now, to explain here about how transportation works, how staggered do the times have to be for bus pickup in order to make sure that buses can drop off the earlier students and then get back out and pick up students who would be going to school
later?
That's
a great question, and it's a very important question. I can't imagine being able to do it in less than an hour, because you're going to have to, you know, you got to go out and run the routes again. In some areas where there's a lot of traffic, in a more urban area, you have more traffic lights, that's going to slow things down. In a more rural area, you're just going to have more miles to travel, and that's going to slow things down. So 75 minutes is what I used to kind of use in my head in the district that I was K-12 superintendent in.
So going back to that quote, if we were just to simply say, okay, we are going to do what's best for learning right now, what would that mean? What time would we be starting school for high schoolers?
Oh, I think, Minnesota's been doing a lot of good work on this last 10 years or so, and I've heard about the 9 o'clock start being a good time for high schoolers. They're going to be more attentive. The later start's going to make it a little easier to get up in the morning. These are all real issues, but we all have body clocks. Adults do, too. And there's times when, my body clock may not, you know, I tend to have I probably shouldn't say this, but I have a little lull late afternoon. And that's very common for adults, kind of that kind of late afternoon lull. Well, I oftentimes have meetings that I need to be on, and I need to be attentive, and I need to be fully engaged, and I am. And so you make the adjustments, you know, whether it's some people drink coffee. So there's a reality that sometimes we as individuals have to fit into the larger society. Employers have their work schedules. And the employer's doing is set the work schedule around the sleep needs of their employees. We would love it if we could. A lot of people like to work from home, and maybe they're on a flexible schedule and they can do that. But the reality is, in society, there's a lot of group norms. There's group structures, and sometimes you just have to conform to that and figure out how to make it work for you as an individual. Maybe it's the teenagers need to go to bed earlier.
Well, and that's a point that came up in the Bridge article, was that was some of the comments that people had in response to this was, well, you know, life is about figuring out how you're going to organize your time, how you're going to show up when you're supposed to show up and make sure that you're functioning. And is it better maybe to be learning that lesson in high school than to be learning it later in life when maybe you already have a job and you're expected to show up for it?
Yeah, I would argue that it is. On the other hand, I mean, you do want to you want schools to be as much focused and tailored to the needs of individuals as possible, but a school is not an individual. It's a group of staff, a group of students, and you try to do what's best for the whole. And this late start idea, I've always loved it, and I've always thought, you know, that could work on a regional or even a state level. Because of all the shared programming concepts, that would really be difficult on the shared programs to have some schools starting late and some starting early. It would essentially make those unmanageable. They would end up imploding if the kids are on different schedules. I thought, well, maybe that'd be a good thing for maybe a smaller state, maybe a Rhode Island or someone like that to pave the way. Does this truly make a difference? But then again, Now you're dealing with the bus driver situation. And do you really want the younger children out at the side of the road? And, you know, when you look at, when you're making decisions, a lot of times we use the old Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, we always talk about it, and it's important because at first people must be safe.
We have to make sure they get to school.
Exactly.
And when they get there, we can do our best with teaching them.
Exactly. And I don't think a lot of parents would be comfortable with young children. Maybe they would. Maybe I'm off base on that. And maybe it's a conversation we should be having. But that seems to be the tone anytime I've heard this come up in the last 15, 17 years as an administrator.
I found the comment about extracurricular activities interesting because it seems to me that there's two ways of looking at that. One is that part of the reason high schoolers may not be able to go to bed earlier is if they're involved in sports. You have a basketball game that could run well past 9 o'clock, and then you still have to get home. And anyone that's been in competitive sports knows you just don't go to bed right away. You need some time to unwind. And, you know, there could be homework that didn't get done, et cetera. Same thing could go for theater, music, that sort of thing. At the same time, there's some people saying, well, if you start later, then you're running up against that time when these things could be beginning. How difficult an issue is that to try to get at?
That's a tough issue. I've heard of some schools that that actually had their practices early in the morning, so that those students who were choosing to be in athletics, they would be the ones to get up early. Then, of course, you know, the jam being is you're right on. You don't just, you know, go home after a basketball game and immediately go to sleep. There is an unwind time. And so those kids would end up being very sleep deprived. And sleep deprivation is a very real issue for all, not just students, but for adults. It's one of the key things that we need to do in taking care of ourselves and our health is making sure we're getting enough sleep. And American culture right now is very, very fast-paced, and there's very little margin in many people's lives to get an adequate amount of sleep. So it's as real of an issue as poor nutrition and not enough exercise. Doctors talk about it all the time because it's really important.
If you were making a list of things that get in the way of a student achieving their true potential in the classroom, would lack of sleep make the top 10, the top 5? I mean, you know, we're probably just guessing here.
In my list, it would probably make a top 10. I think the number of school days that students have, that'd be in my top 10 too. If you look at the performance levels in the top performing nations and academics, most of, not all of them, their students are in school, you know, significantly longer days than our students are, and significantly more days. And so that's another thing that I think the United States needs to take a much closer look at is how much time students are in school and the number of days.
You noted in the article in Bridge that when you were the superintendent of Olivet, that this was a topic that came up often, but we'd always think, do we really want the young kids out at the end of the road in the dark? And is that the thing that prevents any serious discussion of this topic from moving forward is, as you said before, the Maslow's higher needs, safety comes first?
I think it's certainly one of the big, different communities are going to have different issues that hit them particularly hard. I know some communities that it's the athletic voice, you know, but do you really schedule a whole school around athletics? It's not all students that are participating. I know that's significant.
Another child care needs is another one that comes up.
Yeah. Oh, and the students' work needs. A lot of high schoolers are working after school, and they want to be able to get to work so they can earn some money. And if you start school later, then it's going to be later for them to get to work. And so there's a lot of different issues. But it's a good issue to explore, and I'm glad Bridge Magazine put it on our radar.
Dave Campbell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Dave Campbell is superintendent of the Kalamazoo Regional Education Service Agency. The interview with Dave Campbell originally aired in June. You can find the original interview and a link to the article in Bridge at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.